Bloodbath thesis was a critical part of the U.S. government's argument for staying in Southeast Asia in 1975. Nixon and Rockefeller warned that there would be a massive bloodbath in the wake of the U.S. withdrawal from Indochina. The North Vietnamese population classification in the 50s had been smeared as a bloodbath, and we believed that whatever the policies of the governments that would come to power at the end of the Vietnam War, they would be similarly smeared by the Western news media. Our 1979 media study, Human Rights, the New Imperialism, was a major revision of a 1973 work, Bloodbaths, Ideology and Propaganda. Bloodbath studied the institutionalization of atrocity myths, what we called atrocity management in the 1979 edition. The Western news media's coverage of post-Second Indochina War Cambodia demonstrated as clearly as any topic considered in the 1979 study the workings of what we called the free press system of propaganda. The theoretical construct used in our 1979 study to analyze news media response to events in Khmer Rouge, Cambodia was what we called our propaganda model. This model possessed a certain predictive power. Prior to the end of the Second Indochina War, Frank Ulrich, my co-author, had forecast that the media would conjure up a fearsome picture of a massive bloodbath in the wake of the U.S. withdrawal from South Vietnam as post hoc justification for U.S. intervention. In our exposition in Human Rights and the New Imperialism, or what we call mass media supply of and demand for communist atrocities, we say that despite official forecasts that massive reprisals would be a virtually certain result of communist victory in South Vietnam, the promised Vietnamese bloodbath never materialized. Consequently, the press, as the principal proponent of this bloodbath theory, latched onto Cambodian violence as a drowning man seizes a life buoy. Editorial condemnation of Cambodian atrocities in the mainstream media dates from mid-1975, immediately following the victory of the Khmer Rouge. Within a few weeks of the Khmer Rouge takeover, the New York Times, as predicted by our propaganda model, was already accusing the Khmer Rouge of genocide. And from then on, it was a drumbeat, a chorus of genocide, 3.5 years of unrelenting anti-communist atavism. The Second Indochina War had been the seminal experience of the post-1945 era, and a transition to a new era began in 1975. The North Vietnamese, Pathet Lao, Vietnamese Provisional Revolutionary Government, and Khmer Rouge were symbols, as were no others, of a new world the West must accept. We held that the precipitous evacuation of Cambodia's cities in the days following the communist takeover had been entirely rational and justified. The country's tertiary sector, comprised of a Sino-Khmer and Vietnamese mercantile class, as actuaries of foreign business, facilitated the extraction of surplus value from Cambodia. These foreign implantations were a drain on the country's scarce resources, and their dismantlement was an urgent priority for the post-war authorities. Vietnam, in contrast, actually diverted scarce resources in an effort to maintain the artificially inflated living standards of the more privileged sectors of Saigonese society. For almost 3 years, the capitalist heart of southern Vietnam remained largely untouched by the country's new communist rulers. A dependent and unproductive economic sector that the country could hardly tolerate for long. Pol Pot saw, and we believe correctly saw, that Cambodia's tertiary sector was parasitic, and understood that forcibly resettling the urban population in the hinterland to grow rice was necessary to feed the country. A rapid and necessary, if brutal, proletarianization of Cambodia's bourgeoisie was imperative if the country was going to avoid starvation. Sam Simons was co-director in 1975 of the Southeast Asia Resource Center. I had been in North Vietnam with Simons in 1970. The center was a Protestant-sponsored coordinating office that was an adjunct of the peace movement, as far as the movement had any organization, and acted as a mouthpiece for the Vietnamese PRG and political ancillary of the Khmer Rouge. The Khmer Rouge spurned normal diplomatic channels and addressed Western public opinion, when at all, through the informal apparatus of the Solidarity Movement. In 1975, the center organized a New York reception for Yang Sari, Pol Pot's deputy premier. He estimated that the population of Phnom Penh had swollen from 2 million to 3 million preceding the Khmer Rouge takeover. The Cambodians rejected humanitarian aid and were determined to try to reconstruct their society based on what was then the political clarion call of self-reliance. It may have been over self-reliance, but the assumption was that the foreign penetration of the country would have indeed been far more invidious than attempting to get people back to the agricultural level of the pre-war society, and then from that, develop the kind of capital required for national reconstruction. At least 15,000 deaths had resulted from malnutrition in Phnom Penh during the last months of the U.S.-backed republic. And getting the population back to productive labor was an urgent priority for the post-war authorities. The free world had sat back and watched the unprecedented U.S. carpet bombing of Cambodia in 1973. Radical left development theory saw Khmer Rouge communism as a rejection of the free world model for third world development, which we viewed as imperialist and genocidal. And we saw the Khmer Rouge's rejection of humanitarian aid as a categorical refusal of any accommodation with this free world. Colonialism, together with the consequent integration into the international capitalist system as a dependent marginal element was responsible for Cambodia's backwardness. Radical left development theory how that this problem would not be solved by further integration into that system. The cycle of underdevelopment could only be broken by withdrawing from the world economy and restructuring on a self-centered basis. If the human cost was high, such costs had not been unknown in the history of industrialization in the West. Vast social changes were imperative if Cambodia was to overcome centuries of injustice and oppression. All artificial implantations had to be dismantled quickly and without enormous foreign assistance. What we advocated then and continue to do is a spiritual transformation such as those from the left Marxist tradition have always emphasized. Such a transformation implies an attack on the fundamental structure of state capitalism and the system of domination at its control, private control of resources. What happened in Ho Chi Minh's Democratic Republic of Vietnam in the 50s and Pol Pot's Cambodia in 1975 was such an attack? The transcendental nature of the social changes in 1975 Cambodia required the expulsion of almost all foreigners. Only Chinese 707s carrying technicians and telecommunication equipment were allowed to land at Phnom Penh. The population was classified according to class background at sorting centers, and the country was effectively restructured economically. The Western news media and our propaganda model invariably respect certain principles in its coverage of official enemies. A dramatic instance of this, in what we called one of the most egregious displays of hypocritical indignance in modern history, is seen in the July 9, 1975 New York Times editorial condemning Khmer Rouge policy in the weeks following the communist takeover is genocidal, effectively transferring responsibility for suffering in Cambodia from the U.S. to Pol Pot. We called this agent transference, the third principle of our theory of the free press. This ideologically driven distortion in the news media is derived in our model from the operative principle of the free press, economic freedom, which is assumed in the free world model for third world development and is nothing less than the freedom for U.S. business to invest, sell, and repatriate profits, the violation of which thrusts competing socioeconomic systems like Khmer Rouge communism into the international media limelight and sets agent transference and the other principles in our model into motion. Our 1979 media study was largely a rejoinder to the genocide charges against Pol Pot. If there had been no genocide in Khmer Rouge, Cambodia, as we argued, the media would have invented one. What we looked at in our propaganda model was the commodification of rights in the news media. Such an economy presupposes the ascription of some value to the commodities exchanged within it. In the gradient of abuses, economic rights are assumed to be secondary to those to security and life. What we found was that the violation of these rights was secondary and largely irrelevant to news coverage. Pol Pot's Cambodia was a case in point and was thrust into the media limelight to establish the Western press's basic principle that liberation by Marxists was the worst fate that could befall any people under Western domination. The singularity of Cambodia in our model owed to the radicalism of its leadership, as evidence indicating genocide was transparent, the result of what we called an orgy of falsification. Accordingly, since the quality and quantity or strength and behaviorist terms of evidence for genocide was insufficient to provoke the response elicited in the media, we were forced to look for an alternative explanation. By focusing on Cambodian terror, the media served important U.S. interests by allowing strong ideological points to be scored against radicalism, socialism, egalitarianism, and third world nationalism. This focus of the news media had what we called mass media serviceability and advanced the Western press's liberal agenda. I was probably the most prominent exponent of principled opposition to American involvement in the Second Indochina War. The foremost radical critic of American foreign policy. The liberal consensus that followed the Vietnam War effectively marginalized the far left. My opposition to the 1979 Vietnamese invasion of Cambodia only further served to isolate the radical left from the political mainstream. The character of the Khmer Rouge government became apparent in the weeks following its ascension to power. Much as it did in the days after the 1979 Vietnamese invasion, the world waited for the cessation of hostilities to fly aid into 1975 Cambodia. Tons of powdered milk, high-protein food supplement, and other food and medical equipment were waiting to be airlifted in after the takeover. UNICEF, the UN Development Project, the Save the Children Foundation, the French, the Japanese, Thailand, Canada, the Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies were all waiting to send food and medicine. Engineers were on standby waiting for permission to fly in and repair the water filtration system. And planes were waiting in Vientiane for the evacuation of the sick. Again, the Cambodians would countenance no interference, even humanitarian, in their affairs. All offers of aid were refused, and the Khmer Rouge began evicting 20,000 hospital patients into the streets of the capital, compelling the entire population at gunpoint to march for weeks and months into the countryside with no provision for water or medical care. In our 1979 media study, we cite a characterization in Newsweek of Khmer Rouge policy in April 1975 as genocidal, as a kind of ideologically driven blood libel The statement, unattributed in Newsweek, was from Fernand Scheller, chief of the UN Development Project in Phnom Penh. As a relief worker, Scheller was well aware of the needs of the capital's population, which had swollen to over 2 million at the time of the communist takeover. Khmer Rouge rustication policy and repudiation of humanitarian aid led ineluctably to the deaths of tens of thousands of Cambodians in the weeks following the takeover. Instead of being atrocity mongering, as we claimed, Scheller's characterization of Khmer Rouge policy as genocidal was entirely prescient, and the human catastrophe described in the July 1975 New York Times editorial was the tragic realization of the UN officials' anguished prediction. Scheller's Cambodian family was among those forced to leave the capital in the Khmer Rouge's rustication of the country's cities and towns. The evacuation of 20,000 hospital patients after the Khmer Rouge takeover was witnessed by 26 journalists at the French embassy. Families and friends were compelled to carry non-ambulatory patients with their serum drips held over their heads into the countryside in 40 degrees centigrade heat. Rusticants subsisted on surface water, and cholera was controlled by closing sections of highway. A crude birth rate of 4.5% indicates that thousands of pregnancies came to term during the April to June March. Exhaustion and heat prostration must have hit the elderly population extremely hard. Hundreds of thousands of rusticants survived in the little provisions they've been able to carry and camped in squalid conglomerates outside the city. Most have been told that they would be able to return to the capital in 3 days. Cholera spread quickly. A Cambodian physician who spent a month on various roads and trails before escaping to Vietnam recounts treating between 20 and 30 people a day for cholera, half of whom were not going to live. At the height of the epidemic, he passed the body of a child every 200 yards. There are reports of summary executions of entire families for failing to comply immediately with the order to evacuate. Purges began in the days after the takeover. Forced disappearances of entire extended families along the evacuation routes were also reported, along with reports of detainees being taken from the highways and shooting heard afterwards. Execution sites were discovered by rusticants forging besides the highways. Liquidation of Republican soldiers and officers was necessary because they were imperialist strata. Families of former civilian and military officials were also killed. The CIA estimates 50,000 people were executed during the first weeks of Khmer Rouge rule. Our position was that this was comparable to the number of Nazi collaborators executed after the fall of the Vichy regime in 1945 France. Reporting on Pol Pot's Cambodia wasn't the orgy of ideologically driven falsification we claimed. The press had been extremely reluctant to report on the situation in post-war Cambodia, and consequently news from the country went relatively unreported. particularly when you compare it to reporting prior to the 1975 takeover. If hundreds of journalists had covered the end of the Vietnam War, few returned to cover its aftermath. This could be attributed to several things, including saturation on the part of the American public by news of suffering in Indochina, widespread sympathy in the press for the new governments, and the lack of photographic evidence. Reporting on Cambodia during the Pol Pot period, what we called media response from that time, could even be, and has been described as consistently fair, balanced, and accurate. Again, that wasn't our position. What we saw was an extraordinary outpouring of anti-communist fury and outrage issuing from the media. Information on Cambodia in 1975 to 79 was sparse and dominated by reports of refugees, which we said should be regarded with suspicion as it came from sources that could hardly be considered detached and disinterested. Almost all evidence on Cambodia during the Pol Pot period was anecdotal. Refugee protocols compiled by a handful of Cambodia specialists and journalists. We claim that refugees were primed by the CIA and US-backed Thai regime to fabulate atrocity stories. And we dismissed accounts by Cambodian deponents of horrific privation and mass killing as falsifications invented for a sensationalist press. We wrote that refugees questioned by Westerners and Thais had a vested interest in reporting atrocities on the part of the Cambodian revolutionaries and reported what they believed their interlocutors wished to hear. We strongly suspected, that refugee reports were part of a CIA disinformation campaign to discredit the Cambodian regime. The public's impression was that evidence from refugees was uniform. This was the result of what we described as an artifact of media bias. And we believe there was hard evidence controverting this standard media picture. We had Cambodian witnesses who said that sick and wounded at Phnom Penh hospitals were evacuated to more hygienic surroundings after the takeover, and that the weak and elderly were not expected to join in the march. Evidence that we said was suppressed as policy by the liberal news media. This demonstrated our general theory of the free press, which stated that non-atrocity reports of acts commissioned by Marxist regimes are routinely suppressed in the Western media. Our source in the evacuation was Min Krieger, a young Cambodian who was married to an Australian and was expelled with the foreign press. She would later learn that her parents, Sino-Khmer, had been killed by the Khmer Rouge. We had several Khmer-speaking sources on Cambodia who were disinclined to believe refugee accounts of terror and starvation. Victor Jones was a British undergraduate who visited refugee camps in Thailand in 1975. He claimed to have heard a wide range of refugee judgments on the nature of the Pol Pot regime. Jones' early work broke down the class background and region of refugee flow, relating such factors to the social and economic situation that had prevailed prior to the collapse of the U.S.-backed Khmer Republic. Class contradictions being exceptionally sharp, and the settling of scores at the local level in a context of loose governmental authority not being uncommon. He claimed areas where the Khmer Rouge were better organized were less violent. His article, published in an undergraduate journal, was crucially significant to our analysis of the Western propaganda system in regard to Cambodia. Jones ultimately retracted his conclusions regarding the country and would later learn that the family of his wife, a Khmer national, had been massacred by the Khmer Rouge. In 1978, I told the National Post that we didn't believe reprisals and brutality in Pol Pot's Cambodia were the monolith reported in the media. The Post article was the synopsis of our basic argument. Most information gathered in Southeast Asia about Cambodia came from refugees in Thailand. Almost all those refugees came from the northwest of Cambodia, an area which we understood to have never been well controlled by the Khmer Rouge. From this bare-bones intelligence gathering, nationwide extrapolations were drawn, and it was from these projections that Western analysts concluded that Cambodia's leaders were genocidal monsters. That was our argument. Reprisals following the defeat of the Khmer Republic in the Northwest became the kernel of truth that we claimed had later been served up as a genocide myth by the news media to the U.S. public. Former U.S. Secretary of State Henry Kissinger knew in 1973 that the U.S. could not win in Cambodia and ordered the heavy bombing of the country to embitter the enemy and set the stage for the bloodbath thesis, which was being given credence in 1978. This was the thesis of central direction and planning of atrocities on the basis of the alleged uniformity of refugee accounts, and was untenable since, as we believed, refugee reports were not uniform but showed considerable variety. The U.S. State Department, moreover, estimated the death toll in Khmer Rouge, Cambodia at tens if not hundreds of thousands, and not the millions reported in the press. No one ever asked us why the CIA was mounting a massive disinformation campaign to discredit the Cambodian revolutionaries, at the same time that the State Department was playing down the death toll. State Department, however, never claimed to have substantial information on Cambodia. Witnesses for the U.S. government told hearings that their information was inadequate and that their information on the human destruction occasioned since the Pol Pot takeover could be off by a factor of 10. The American government, despite our claims, had no interest in discrediting the Cambodian regime. No one in the region wanted a Vietnamese invasion of Cambodia. Thailand in particular did not want the Vietnamese army on its eastern border, and the U.S. was hostage to Thai concerns. Our argument that the U.S. had some ideological agenda in Southeast Asia after 1975 was a gross simplification and completely untenable. The northwest of Cambodia, despite our claims in the post, was completely controlled by Pol Pot. Hundreds of thousands of people had been deported there in September 1975. 80,000 people may have died just from the conditions of the deportation. After the harvest, purges began again. Reports from the zone could be cross-referenced, and the New York Times would later send a reporter to interview refugees in Thai holding centers immediately after they had escaped from Cambodia, so that their stories would not be contaminated by contact with other refugees in the camps. Again, our argument was something quite different, to the effect that massacre reports were false and testified to the extreme unreliability of refugee accounts. Credible reports, and there were many we claimed, exonerated the Pol Pot Politburo and indicated that extrajudicial killing was localized in areas of limited Khmer Rouge influence and unusual peasant discontent. The classless nature of the new social order under Pol Pot explained the horror and indignation of the urban bourgeoisie at its practices. And it was this prejudice against socialism that we said biased reports in the closed country. I told the Fourth Committee of the UN General Assembly in 1978 that international reaction to events in post-war Cambodia revealed the emptiness and hypocrisy of much of the concern for human rights, which had moved to stage center just at the moment when the luster of classical colonialist and interventionist ideologies had dimmed. Whatever the situation in Cambodia, it was beyond the reach of Western human rights activists. And the committee heard that sources on Cambodian atrocities had little credibility. In Human Rights and the New Imperialism, we claim that the worst terror in Cambodia had ended by 1977. Something happened, however, early that year in the Pol Pot Politburo, and whatever inhibitions it previously had disappeared. The killing in the country took on a systemic quality, and hundreds of thousands were methodically purged. In 1980, we claimed that 50,000 Cambodians had been executed during the Pol Pot period. The actual figure is over 1 million. Our bias was as much a product of ideological blindness as a news media deception we claim to expose. The dream of a classless society became a nightmare.